I know we all like meat in due season, so today we're going to talk about Esther. 1 week from tomorrow is the Jewish festival of Purim. So let's dive a little into the context of Purim and the story surrounding it, the story of Esther. There are a few lessons that we can learn from the story of Esther, and in some ways we can glean a little extra by understanding the context. And while we dive into the context, here are the main points that I want to focus on. How do you make decisions? How does pride affect your decision-making process? When and how do you seek God for his guidance? So, context. Let's start with the king's background. Who were the kings of Persia? The Persian Empire, as we know it, was founded by Cyrus the Great, Kurash. When Cyrus died, his son Cambyses II ascended to the throne. When Cambyses died, his brother Bardia was next in line. But Bardia was assassinated by Darius and six co-conspirators. Darius claimed he actually killed a magician doppelganger, that Cambyses and Bardia fought and killed each other, and this doppelganger magician took advantage of the resulting confusion. Darius claimed that he and Cyrus the Great were both descendants of Achaemenes, and therefore named the dynasty after him. That's where we get the Achaemenid dynasty, or as we often pronounce it, the Achaemenid dynasty. Historians find this claim of common ancestry dubious. To solidify his claim, Darius married Atossa, a daughter of Cyrus, and it was partly due to Atossa that her son and Darius's preferred heir, Xerxes, ascended to the throne when Darius died, instead of Artabazarnes, Darius's oldest son, born to him before he rose to power. The manner of Darius's ascension established two major personality traits: paranoia and gratitude. Darius was paranoid that he would also be assassinated, so he greatly restricted access to his person. Only those six conspirators who helped him overthrow Bardia, or the doppelganger, could call on Darius, except when he was otherwise engaged. When Intephernes, one of these six, tried to call on Darius and was told by the guards that he was otherwise engaged, he rebelled. He cut off the noses and ears of the guys that were guarding the door and rebelled against Darius. And Darius then killed Intephernes and his whole family, or most of it anyway. Gratitude. Darius was careful to repay his debts, to reward those who served him well, as he did with the six conspirators. These six were perhaps awarded the most valuable commodity, near unfettered access to the king. There's another story where Darius repaid an old debt to a Greek called Solosson. Darius commissioned an enormous engraving called the Behistun engraving. It's 15 meters tall by 25 meters wide that told his claim, his story of his ascendance to the throne. Darius wanted his prosperity to emulate Cyrus as he did, and he engraved a warning to his heirs that any edict from the throne must be honored in perpetuity. No edict from the throne could be undone. All of this sets the backdrop for the story of Esther. How much of this sounds familiar, or at least harmonizes with various aspects of the story of Esther? Who has access to the king? The king always repays his debts. No edict from the throne can be undone. In the greater context, when did this happen? In a biblical context, this clearly happens after the events recorded in Daniel. It was during Daniel's time that Zerubbabel led the Jews back to Jerusalem and laid the foundation for the second temple. In Ezra chapter 5, the Jews claimed that Cyrus had given them permission to rebuild the temple. In response, Darius ordered a search through the archives and found the decree, a key component of Darius's decision-making process. Was, what would Cyrus do? When he found Cyrus's decree, Darius doubled down on it. Let's look at Ezra 6. There we go. Ezra chapter 6, verse 3. This is Darius speaking. In the first year of Kurash the king issued this decree. Concerning the house of God in Jerusalem, let the house be rebuilt, the place where they offer sacrifices, and let its foundations be firmly laid. Its height is to be 90 feet, and its breadth 90 feet, with three rows of large stones and one row of new timber. The expenses are to be charged to the king's treasury. Also, let the gold and silver articles belonging to the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar removed from the temple at Jerusalem and brought to Babel, be restored and returned to the temple in Jerusalem, each item to its place, and you are to put them in the house of God. Therefore, Tatnai, governor of the territory beyond the river, Shetarboznai, and your colleagues, the officials beyond the river, stay away from there. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Judeans and the leaders of the Judeans rebuild this house of God on the site. Moreover, I herewith issue this order concerning how you are to assist these leaders of the Judeans in rebuilding this house of God. The expenses of these men are to be defrayed promptly from the royal funds, from the taxes collected beyond the river, so that the work can continue. Whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for burnt offerings to the house, to the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and olive oil, according to what the priests in Jerusalem say, is to be given them daily without fail, so that they can offer sacrifices with a fragrant aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Let's skip a couple of verses, or actually let's go on to the next verse, and look at the punishment decreed by Darius for someone who interferes with the building of the second temple. I also order that if anyone defies this order, a beam is to be pulled from his house, and he is to be lifted up and impaled on it. His house is to be reduced to rubble. May the God who has caused his name to be there overthrow any king or people that tries to defy it and defy this house of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have issued this order. Let it be carried out to the letter. Darius ascended to the throne in 522 BC. It was at the beginning of 516 BC that the second temple was completed. Skip down to verse 14. The leaders of the Judeans made good progress with the rebuilding, thanks to the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They kept building until they were finished, in keeping with the command of the God of Israel and in accordance with the order of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. This house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. The people of Israel, the Kohanim, the priests, the Levites, and the other people from the exile joyfully dedicated this house of God. At the dedication of this house of God, they offered 100 young bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats corresponding to the number of the tribes of Israel. Adar. Adar is the last month of the Hebrew year. In years with an intercalary month, the extra month is also called Adar. You get Adar 1 and Adar 2. We'll get back to that. Outside the Bible, Herodotus writes about Darius attacking the Greek city-states after the Ionian Revolt. Darius's generals were ultimately thwarted at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. Darius rebuilt his army, but died suppressing a revolt in Egypt before he could lead the expedition against the Greeks. The unfinished business in Egypt and Greece was left to his son, Xerxes. And when Xerxes ascended to the throne in 486 BC, 30 years after the completion of the Second Temple. So which king is this that we see in Esther? Josephus claims that this king in Esther was Artaxerxes. But the Hebrew is closer to that of Xerxes, the son of Darius. Xerxes, however, comes from the Persian Khishayarsha, which is a much closer match to the Hebrew Ahasuerus, where all of the consonants, except for that V in the middle, is a match for the Persian. Furthermore, the personality of Ahasuerus is a decent match for the personality that Herodotus ascribes to Xerxes. Chapter 1 of Esther happens in the third year of Xerxes' reign. Shortly before he leads the army, his father built against the Greeks. The large banquets in this chapter look like morale-building celebrations in anticipation of the campaign. Xerxes defeated the Spartans at Thermopylae and razed Athens, but his navy was defeated at Salamis and his army was defeated at Plataea. So the king that we see in the rest of Esther is a defeated king. He's lost his army. He's suffered defeat at the fringes of his empire. Let's look at the introduction to Esther and her uncle Mordecai in Esther 2. Esther, chapter 2, starting in verse 5. There was in Shushan, the capital, a man who was a Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. He had been exiled from Jerusalem with the captives exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, had carried off. He had raised Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, because she had neither father nor mother. The girl was shapely and good-looking. After her father's and mother's death, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. Who is another Benjamite? Who was also a son of Kish? Saul. 1 Samuel chapter 9. 1 Samuel chapter 9, starting in verse 1. There was a man from Benjamin named Kish, the son of Aviel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorat, the son of Aphtiach, the son of a man from Benjamin. He was a man of substance and brave as well. He had a son named Shaul, or Saul, who was young and good looking. Among the people of Israel, there was no one better looking than he. He stood head and shoulders taller than anyone else in Israel. Once the donkeys belonging to Kish, Saul's father, got lost, Kish said to his son Saul, "Please, take one of the servants with you. Go out and look for the donkeys." Saul eventually goes on to become the first king of Israel. At the beginning of Esther chapter 3, we're introduced to the primary villain in the book of Esther. Let's turn there. There we are. Esther 3, verse 1. Sometime later, King Ahasuerus began to single out Haman, the son of Hamdata, the Agagite, for advancement. Eventually, he gave him precedence over all his fellow officers. What is an Agagite? The simple answer, perhaps the obvious answer, is that an Agagite is a descendant of Agag. And who was Agag? Let's go to 1 Samuel 15. At some point, I'm going to have to bookmark where Esther is. 1 Samuel 15, verse 20. Saul said to Samuel, "I did too pay attention to what the Lord said, and I carried out the mission on which the Lord sent me. I brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and I completely destroyed Amalek. But the people took some of the spoil, the best of the sheep and cattle set aside for destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." This is the act of disobedience that causes Saul to lose favor in the sight of God. God withdraws his spirit from Saul, and an evil spirit comes instead. Agag was the king of an ancient enemy of the Israelites, the Amalekites. The Amalekites were the first to attack Israel on their way from Egypt to Mount Sinai. That is in Exodus 17. Let's go there. You might remember this story. Exodus 17, verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us. Go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with God's staff in my hand." Joshua did as Moses had told him and fought with Amalek. Then Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. When Moses raised his hand, Israel prevailed. But when he let it down, Amalek prevailed. However, Moses' hands grew heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, the one on one side and the other on the other, so that his hands stayed steady until sunset. Then thus Joshua defeated Amalek, putting their people to the sword. The Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book to be remembered and tell it to Joshua. I will completely blot out any memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar, called it Adonai Nisi, and said, "Because their hand was against the throne of God, the Lord will fight Amalek generation after generation." So here in Esther, the narrator has set the stage. First, we have Xerxes, a defeated king. By the end of the first chapter, Xerxes is painted also as a king who can't even manage his own house or make his own decisions. Furthermore, Xerxes, either by upbringing or by circumstances, also appears to be disconnected from the people. Then we have Esther and her uncle Mordecai set up against Haman with shadows of a blood feud hanging over them. Mordecai has some authority because he is able to sit at or patrol the king's gate. Haman is a petty man who lets pride influence his decision-making process. Let's go back to Esther 3. Esther chapter 3. Now we read verse 1. Sometime later, King Ahasuerus began to single out Haman, the son of Hamdada, the Agagite, for advancement. Eventually, he gave him precedence over all his fellow officers. Continuing in verse 2, all the king's servants at the king's gate would kneel and bow down before Haman, because the king had so ordered. But Mordecai would neither kneel nor bow down to him. The king's servants at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why don't you break the king's order? Why don't you obey the king's order?" But after they had confronted him a number of times without his paying attention to them, they told Haman, in order to find out whether Mordecai's explanation that he was a Jew would suffice to justify his behavior. Haman was furious when he saw that Mordecai was not kneeling down and bowing down to him. Moreover, on learning what people Mordecai belonged to, it seemed to him a waste to lay his hands only on Mordecai. Rather, he decided to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole of Ahasuerus' kingdom. See what I mean about pride? Haman is so upset that this one man won't bow down to him that he decides to kill all of the Jews, not just this one. Let's look at Esther. Esther is introduced in verse 7 of chapter 2. Most of chapter 2 happens to Esther. The author largely paints her as passive. Esther was taken. Esther didn't ask for anything. Esther was admitted. Esther was admired. Esther was brought. Only in verse 9 do we see the active tense. Esther pleased Haggai and won his favor. The next time Esther is the subject of an active verb is at the end of chapter 2, when Mordecai tells her about an assassination plot and she reports it to the king. While one might interpret this as Esther having little agency, this doesn't seem to be the case. The narrator hints that Esther actually made the most of her situation. She won Haggai's favor, and he gave her preferential treatment. Haggai and the women attending Esther seemed to be giving her a leg up. When it was time for Esther to appear before the king, she asked for and needed nothing but her education and reputation. Let's look at the lots in chapter 3. Now, the casting of lots is actually found in several places. In Leviticus 16, Aaron cast lots for the two goats on the Day of Atonement, one lot for the Lord and one for Azazel. In Numbers 26, the land of Israel is parceled out by lot. The Lord said to Moses, "The land is to be parceled out among these as a possession to be inherited according to the number of names." If you want to follow along, this is in Numbers 26, verses 52 through 56. Numbers 26, verses 52 through 56. The land is to be parceled out among these as a possession to be inherited according to the number of names. To those families with more persons, you are to give a greater inheritance, and to those with fewer, you are to give a smaller inheritance. Each family's inheritance is to be given according to the number counted in it. However, the land is to be awarded by lot. They will inherit according to the names of the tribes of their ancestors, but the inheritance is to be parceled out by lot between the families with more and those with fewer. In Joshua 18, Joshua cast lots in the presence of God to assign the land of Israel to the tribes that which had not claimed land east of the Jordan. In Judges 20, the Israelites cast lots to determine who would take vengeance against the Benjamites for killing the Levite's concubine. In 1 Samuel 14, the priest cast lots to determine who had sinned after Saul had commanded a fast. And the Levites cast lots in 1 Chronicles 25 to determine the order of service. In several places, even sometimes at God's own command, lots are cast as a device to determine his will. This wasn't exclusive to the Israelites. Haman also believed that the casting of lots could be used to determine the divine will. Haman, however, gets a raw deal. He has allowed pride to push him into killing all the Jews and is only divining when to follow through on that. In Esther 3, verse 7, we see how this plays out. Esther 3, verse 7. In the first month, the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of Achashverosh, they began throwing pur. That is, they cast lots before Haman every day and every month until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then in verse 13, letters were sent by courier to all the royal provinces to destroy, kill, and exterminate all Jews from young to old, including small children and women, on a specific day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to seize their goods as plunder. Here it is, the first month of the year, indeed, the day before Passover, when Haman casts the lots to determine when to commit this genocide. And what date does he get? The 13th day of the 12th month. He must have been pretty frustrated to have to wait almost a whole year before he could execute his plan. Remember how the narrator set up the king as indecisive in verse one, in chapter 1, where he goes to his counselors to tell him what to do? He's easily manipulated. He's disconnected from the people. That's being reinforced here in chapter 3. Haman comes to the king and says, "There are these disobedient people you should kill, and I'll provide the money to execute them." And the king says, "Don't bother me with this. Here, take my ring and deal with it yourself." And after the orders go out, Haman and the king sit down for drinks while the rest of the people are thrown into confusion. You can see that at the end of chapter 3. So then Esther 4 starts with a public display of grief. Western sensibilities have long encouraged men to be stoic and keep their grief private. So this is somewhat foreign to us. However, we have several examples of public grief in the Bible. whether tearing one's coat, wearing sackcloth, or throwing dust or ashes onto one's head. Jacob wore sackcloth when he mourned Joseph in Genesis 37:34. David wore sackcloth when he mourned Abner in 2 Samuel 3:31. David's daughter Tamar tore her robe and put ashes on her head after being defiled by her brother Amnon in 2 Samuel 13, verse 19. David wore sackcloth when God sent a plague upon Israel after David's census in 1 Chronicles 21:16. Hezekiah wore sackcloth when Jerusalem was besieged. This is in 2 Kings 19:1 through 4 and Isaiah 37:1 and 2. Job's friends tear their coats and throw dust on their heads when they find him in Job 2, verse 12. Daniel wears sackcloth when considering the expulsion from and prophesied return of the Israelites to the promised land. That's in Daniel 9, verses 2 and 3. And then the people of Nineveh wear sackcloth when confronted with the prophecy of Jonah in Jonah 3, 5 through 8. This is both an act of humility and a call for attention. Mordecai has clearly changed his appearance, but this choice also prevents him from sitting at the king's gate. His presence at the king's gate led him to discover that assassination plot at the end of chapter 2. Mordecai gives up this privilege because this public display of grief is more important to him. Clearly, it worked. Esther may have been in her own bubble, but her attendants noticed and brought it to her attention. Esther didn't talk to Mordecai herself. She may not have been allowed. She used an official, probably another eunuch, to relay messages between them. Let's look at Esther 4 and start in verse 12. Esther 4, starting in verse 12. Upon being told what Esther had said, Mordecai asked them to give Esther this answer. Don't suppose that merely because you happen to be in the royal palace, you will escape any more than the other Jews. For if you fail to speak up now, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from a different direction. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows whether you didn't come into your royal position precisely for such a time as this? Mordecai reveals Esther's secret to this official. Did he do this to force her hand? Look, this official knows your secret now. You can't hide the fact that you're a Jew anymore. In her conversation with Mordecai, Esther points out that the king hasn't seen her for at least 30 days. Darius's royal decree made it difficult for most people to get an audience with him. Esther also takes her time. She fasts. She probably prays for 3 days, seeking guidance for how to proceed. She doesn't let pride get in her way. And once she's made her decision, what must she have been feeling when she entered the king's presence without permission? After risking her life this way, she asks him to dinner. Did she read the room and realize this wasn't the right time to call Haman out? Even after a dinner with the king and Haman, she doesn't call Haman out, but asks for another dinner the next day. Did she know that the time still wasn't right? Look at what happens between the two banquets. Haman returns from this first banquet in good spirit. But then Mordecai spoils his mood again. He talks with his wife and his friends, and they convince him to construct a gallows on which to hang Mordecai. Is this the same kind of gallows that Darius ordered to be constructed for someone who interfered with the construction of the temple? Pride gets the better of Haman again. He can't stand being snubbed by Mordecai anymore. What else happens? The king can't sleep. So he orders the servants to read the daily journal, and he realizes that Mordecai has rendered him a service, and that service has gone unpaid. Remember that personality trait? I don't let my debts go unpaid. The king is panged by guilt over his failure to repay this debt. And who just happens to be in the courtyard when the king realizes he needs to pay an unpaid debt? Haman has come, and he wants a writ of execution. But the king has something else in mind, and he orders Haman to honor Mordecai instead. And after honoring Mordecai all day, following behind him, riding on a horse, Mordecai is riding on this horse. Now you know what it's like to be following behind a horse all day. Haman seeks sympathy from his wife and friends, but they tell him, "You're up against a Jew. You're not going to win." This is the turning point of the story. Things probably wouldn't have played out the same if Esther had called Haman out at the first banquet. Also, look at this following verse in Esther 6. Esther 6, verse 14. While Haman's wife and his friends were still talking with him, the king's officials came, hurrying to bring Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. So here is Haman after a long day walking behind a horse. And he hasn't had time to finish venting his humiliation or change out of his dirty clothes when he's ordered to come to Esther's second banquet. What is his frame of mind when he arrives? Where is his pride? After Esther calls Haman out at the second dinner, Haman embarrasses himself in front of the king and is hung on the very gallows he'd constructed for Mordecai's execution. In Esther 8, verse 2, we see that Haman still had the king's signet ring. The king then bestows his favor on Esther and Mordecai. And how did Esther and Mordecai respond once Haman was out of the way? That's in Esther 8, starting in verse 7. Esther 8, verse 7. King Ahasuerus said to Esther the queen and Mordecai the Jew, "Listen, I gave Esther the house of Haman, and they hanged him on the gallows because he threatened the lives of the Jews. You should issue a decree in the king's name for whatever you want concerning the Jews and seal it with the king's signet ring, because a decree written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring can't be rescinded by anyone." So once again, the king hands his authority over instead of taking action himself, like he's saying, "I don't want to think about it. You figure it out." Mordecai and Esther can't rescind Haman's order since they were issued as a decree of the king, so they have to come up with something else. And essentially what they send out is a mirror copy of Haman's orders. This is in verse 11. Esther 8, verse 11. The letter said that the king had granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and defend their lives by destroying, killing, and exterminating any forces of any people or province that would attack them, their little ones, or their women, or would try to seize their goods as plunder on the designated day in any of the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. Let's take a step back and look at the timeline. Haman issued his order on the 13th day of the first month. Then Esther and Mordecai write up their mirrored version of that decree and send it out. And this is in verse 9 Esther 8, verse 9. The king's secretaries were summoned at that time on the 23rd day of the third month, the month of Sivan. And a decree was written according to everything Mordecai ordered concerning the Jews to the army commanders, governors, and officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in its script and to each people in their language, also to the Jews in their script and language. 2 months have passed from Haman's decree to Mordecai's decree on the 23rd day of the third month. And for reference, Pentecost falls between the 5th and 11th days of the third month. Both Haman's decree and Esther's and Mordecai's decree specify the 13th day of the 12th month. The Jews still have almost 9 months to prepare their defenses. And when do the Jews observe Purim? That's in Esther chapter 9, starting in verse 16. Esther 9, verse 16. The other Jews, those in the royal provinces, had assembled, defended their lives, and won rest from their enemies, killing 75,000 of those who hated them, but without touching the spoil, on the 13th day of the month Adar. So, on the 14th day of Adar, they rested and made it a holiday for celebrating and rejoicing. However, the Jews of Shushan assembled on both the 13th and 14th days of Adar, so it was on the 15th that they rested and made it a holiday for celebrating and rejoicing. This is why the Jews of the villages, those who live in unwalled towns, make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of celebrating and rejoicing, a holiday, and a time for sending each other portions of food. As mentioned in Esther 3, Adar is the name of the 12th month. And if there are 13 months, the Jewish calendar ends with Adar 1 and Adar 2. Today is the 6th day of Adar 2. And the Jews will be celebrating Purim on the 14th and 15th of Adar 2. So that is not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, Sunday and Monday. The Jews outside of Jerusalem celebrate Purim on the 14th with those who live in unwalled towns. And the Jews in Jerusalem celebrate Purim on the 15th with the Jews of Shushan. So what's the point? Everything recorded in the Bible refers to a particular time and place. And sometimes we get a better understanding with the context of that time and place. The history of the kings of Persia helps lay the foundation for Esther's situation. Xerxes demonstrates his father's paranoia and his compunction to pay his debts. The story of Esther happened between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. The Jews avoided destruction during the reign of Xerxes. How would things have played out otherwise? And Persia is in a bit of a slump after having been defeated by the Greeks. What are some of the lessons we can learn? Make your own decisions. The failure of the king to make his own decisions nearly led to one massacre and resulted in a civil war. Don't let pride rule. Look at where pride got Haman. And on the flip side, Mordecai and Esther humbled themselves and came out ahead. And finally, seek God's help. Esther and Mordecai made a plan, but they also sought God's guidance and blessing.